Chapter 2. Hemorrhagic Stroke.
So let's go back to that case that we heard at the top of the episode there, that patient who was working under a house, and then basically he collapsed, somehow managed to call for help or got found eventually, and then brought in. And I mean, you can hear in that audio clip, it's pretty impressive. He's got a very prominent dysarthria.
And also it's pretty clear that he had a focal weakness. He had a right-sided weakness. He articulated that. And so when you put that all together, he falls into the, hey, this is pretty clearly a stroke. There's not much question about it.
So let's go to the resident, Dr. Dmitry Stablovsky, and we can hear the exam and what his thoughts are about the differential and the plan.
Here I come to save the day.
That means that Luther
is on the way.
His exam findings were, he was confused, so we put his GCS at a 14. He had left gaze deviation and kind of left beating nystagmus as well. He was unable to look to the right. And he had nearly flaccid paralysis of the right side of his body, right upper and lower extremities, would not withdraw to pain on the lowers and would follow commands and squeeze a little bit with his right hand.
What do you think's going on with him and what do you want to do?
So this would be concerning for stroke versus seizure versus dissection with some other etiology of intracranial issues going on. I mean, the first thing you always want to do in an altered patient is the IVO2 monitor ABCs and check their glucose. And so we checked his glucose and it was 150. Okay, so let's get labs drawn on the patient, the CBC, chemistry, coags. Let's get an EKG, make sure he's not having an arrhythmia or an AFib event right now. And let's get a chest x-ray. And then let's rush him up to the CT scanner.
So, of course, with this patient, it's CT first, CT, CT, CT right away. And then after the CT is done, then you can do the rest of the workup that Dr. Stablovsky is discussing.
Well, I was just going to point out that it can be very difficult to tell the difference between a cortical deficit where you're sure the patient's not able to think properly, so they have a speech problem or an organizational problem, they're confused. That's usually a cortical thing that's in the surface of the brain. And that's important because those types of strokes are usually supplied by the large vessels that we can do interventions on, interventional radiology. And strokes that don't have any cortical involvement, they just affect, for example, the speech, and they have to do with the deeper structures like the one that we saw in this case. In this case, the patient just had problems with his speech itself, the mechanics of speech, because of the descending fibers that are coming from the cortex that are going through the basal ganglia area, but he doesn't actually have a cortical problem with word finding. It's just a mechanical dysarthria problem. But these things can be very, very difficult to establish in the emergency department, and they're especially troubling when you're trying to consent someone for TPA because you don't know whether or not they've really got a thinking or a confusion problem or if they're just slurring their speech because of a mechanical problem.
Let's take a listen to the CT head results. What's the CT show?
So the CT showed left-sided basal ganglia hemorrhagic stroke with intraventricular extension. No shift.
And we actually have images of the CT scan of this patient's brain that you can look at right now on the website or on your phone.
Okay, so he's having what I think most of us would refer to as a hypertensive hemorrhage. These are hemorrhages in the deep sites of the brain, usually the basal ganglia, the thalamus, the cerebellum, or the pons. Those are the four classic sites. And his presentation is very consistent with that, Jess. He's had a sudden onset that goes together with a sudden bleeding that's happening in this deep area in the basal ganglia. And it so happens that all the fibers, the motor fibers for the right side of the body are passing through the left, just beside the capsule, right beside the left basal ganglia.
Mm-hmm.
And people can often have very severe paralysis of their whole side of their body, their face, their arm, and their leg, just with one of these deep bleeds that's adjacent to the descending fibers. And so that's very characteristic, actually. And also, the other thing that's really important about this site of hemorrhage, Jess, is that, as you can see, it's close to the ventricular system. In effect, in this case, it's dissecting right into the ventricle. There's blood that's actually dissecting into the ventricular space in the brain. And that gives him a real setup for hydrocephalus. And so one of the things that differentiates a hemorrhagic stroke from your more typical ischemic strokes is that you sometimes need to decompress this blockage of CSF. That's done by a ventricular drain usually.
So this guy has blood in his brain, but there are lots of different types of brain bleeds and the differences can really change the management. So Stuart, let's walk through what are the major types of brain bleeds and how are they different.
By the way, we classify all these, Jess, as strokes, because by definition, a stroke is an event that happens in the brain in a vascular territory because of a vascular event. So it doesn't necessarily have to be arterial. It could be venous. And it includes all the things that we think of when we think of sudden brain bleeds. So subarachnoid hemorrhage, for example. What we just talked about in this case, hypertensive hemorrhage. That's a very common one. There's also hemorrhagic extensions of ischemic strokes. That's a different duck, if you will, altogether, where they have an ischemic stroke, and then down the road, it hemorrhages into the area that was infarcting. And all of these tend to have very different patterns on the CT, and it's important to differentiate between them because they have different treatments. Some of their treatments are similar. Like in all of them, you want to stop the bleeding, and so if they're coagulopathic, you have to stop it. In all of them, you have to pay attention to their blood pressure, but to differing degrees, and there's some other aspects of the management which are completely different. So, for example, in the case of subarachnoid hemorrhage, you have to go and find where there's an aneurysm, and it needs to be coiled or clipped. It's a surgical matter. Whereas in hypertensive hemorrhage, there's no aneurysm bleeding, so there's no issue with that, having to get an angiogram, for example, but there's a big issue with hydrocephalus developing and the possibility they might need that type of neurosurgical intervention. So those are basically the three major types of stroke bleeding that happens, the subarachnoids, the hypertensive hemorrhages, and the hemorrhagic extension of ischemic strokes. But there's other things that come up as well. Sometimes there's occult trauma, and you see bleeding in the CT from there's a subdural, or there's an epidural hematoma. And there's other stuff as well. You can have, we'll mention it just briefly, you can have a stroke from a venous source. You can have a blood clot in the venous system, cerebral venous thrombosis, for example, which can also present like a sudden cerebral event, just like a stroke, but there's going to be important differences in their management. And so that's sort of a general survey. It's not completely exhaustive, but the critical thing is that they all share some things in common in terms of stopping the bleeding, coagulopathy, blood pressure control, and they have some things that are very different in terms of needing neurosurgical intervention and for what.
Okay, so there's blood in the brain, this patient's having a stroke, and for this patient in particular, it's a hypertensive hemorrhagic bleed, most likely. So what are we going to do for him? Well, the good news is that whether it is a hemorrhagic stroke or an ischemic stroke, a lot of the management is the same. So that takes a lot of the pressure off. There's some really basic stuff that you're going to do for the patient, and beyond that, you're involving specialists for potential treatment options. So there's a few things that you're going to do right off the bat, whether this is an ischemic stroke or a hemorrhagic stroke like this patient is having. And I'm just going to give you the rapid list, and then we could talk about each one in more detail. So number one, you're going to manage the airway if needed. Two, elevate the head of the bed to 30 degrees. Three, manage their blood pressure. We'll talk about the goals in a moment. And number four, you're going to reverse anticoagulants. So why do we elevate the head of the bed? Well, that's really important for a few reasons. One of them is because it decreases the rate of aspiration. So the patient may be a little bit confused, may not be handling their secretions well, may be altered. And the last thing that we want is for them to aspirate and then develop pneumonia down the line.
The other reason why we elevate the head of the bed is that it encourages the drainage, the venous drainage of the brain through the jugular veins. And that really plays into the cerebral perfusion, as well as the intracranial pressure. And so very important to get that brain draining, as it were.
Brain drain.
Yeah. I never thought of that. Brain drain, right. In a good way.
Okay.
Venous drain.
All right, blood pressure management. So if the blood pressure is too high, we want to lower that because we don't want them to continue to bleed. But Stuart, I feel like they're constantly changing what is the blood pressure goal. And it's always so hard to remember the blood pressure goal between hemorrhagic strokes in ischemic strokes. So what's the goal for a hemorrhagic stroke?
In general, most of the guidelines now, Jess, seem to be using a number of somewhere between 140 and 180 systolic in terms of what your initial goal is in patients with these hypertensive hemorrhages.
So this is sort of an ongoing controversy of like, what is the exact target blood pressure? And there was a recent paper chase on MRAP from February 2017 that goes into the details of one of the papers on brain bleeds and blood pressure. And in that paper, they actually found there was no difference in outcomes between a target blood pressure of 140 versus 180. The next thing that you're going to have to do is reverse anticoagulation. I mean, this seems obvious, right, Stuart? If the patient is on warfarin, We don't want them to continue bleeding into their brain. So we're going to try to reverse their anticoagulation. So you're going to do this with PCC if you have it at your institution. And if you don't have that available, then you're going to be giving fresh frozen plasma.
Yeah, the bottom line here is that whatever they're on that's making their blood thin, that's making them bleed, you got to reverse it. That's the bottom line. And so that's become a lot more complicated in the past few years than it used to be. But any way that you can, you need to do that as quickly as possible.
And if the patient is on one of the newer oral anticoagulants, the dabigatrans and the apixabans and rivaroxabans, then in general, you're giving PCC for that as well. There is a specific reversal agent for dabigatrans. So if they happen to be on that, then you would give idarucizumab, which is the reversal agent. A question that comes up frequently is about whether or not we're going to give platelets for patients who are on aspirin.
We actually covered this in the EMA in September last year. In 2016, the big patch trial was in the New England Journal, actually looked at giving platelets to people in this situation that had hemorrhagic strokes that were on aspirin or any other antiplatelet agents. And they actually did worse to patients if they were given the platelet transfusion. And so this has actually changed my practice and a lot of other people's practice. Because, you know, you don't want to give an intervention if the only evidence you have that's good evidence is that it harms people.
Another thing you want to do for management. So if this patient has only had a non-contrast head CT, and you see what looks like a subarachnoid bleed, then you want to do a CT angiogram of the brain. And that's because you may be calling in your neurointerventionalist if there is an aneurysm that could be clipped.
That's exactly right, Jess. And it's the appearance of the bleeding on that initial non-contrast CT that enables you to decide what the next important steps are. And so, for example, you would want to get an angiogram, a CT angio, right away if you saw what looked like a spontaneous subarachnoid hemorrhage. You see blood in all the subarachnoid spaces. You're going to go ahead and get an angio and find out, is there an aneurysm responsible for that? Contrast that with the case that we just discussed, where you have a patient with a hypertensive hemorrhage, a deep bleed in the basal ganglia. That's not from an aneurysm. And so that patient doesn't necessarily need any further neuroimaging. But I think that it brings up the important point, which is it kind of helps to have an initial kind of wet read of that non-contrast CT while the patient's still on the table to decide whether or not they should stay there for continuing imaging. And this is something that comes up a lot practically in our management.
Another thing that we often do in the emergency department is give the patient an anti-epileptic, which is really important, but only in certain types of hemorrhagic strokes, right, Stuart? Because it's not all of them that need an anti-epileptic.
Yeah, this is actually something that's really changed quite a bit in the past few years. We used to teach, hey, listen, give anti-epileptics to everyone, because what's the downside? But people should be aware that there are certain studies out there that show that anti-epileptics might have some bad long-term effects on the outcome of brain-injured people. So with that in mind, we want to kind of limit our anti-epileptics to those patients that are either seizing or have seized. Those are for sure patients that need
right.
it. Or the patients that have a high likelihood of having a seizure, because we know how deleterious a seizure can be on their outcome of their brain injury. I mean, the blood pressure problems associated with the oxygenation problems associated with a seizure, ICP can go through the roof. I mean, it's really bad if they seize, so we want to prevent it. And so, again, with that all in mind, the patients that are most likely to seize are the ones that have blood irritating the surface of the brain, the cortex of the brain. So a patient with a big subarachnoid hemorrhage, for sure, I'm going to give prophylactic anti-epileptics to. Patients that have hemorrhage in a lobe on the surface of the cortex of the brain are at high risk. Patients with deeper bleeds, like the basal ganglia bleed that we have in our current case, they're not likely to seize. And so the risk-benefit equation really changes for them, and I won't give them anti-epileptics.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And then, of course, these patients should be admitted to an ICU. That's really, really important for a number of reasons. They get really close nursing care, close monitoring, and they get very frequent neuro checks. So these patients are all going, ideally, to a neuro or medical ICU or surgical ICU.
No, I can't agree more. And things will change very quickly with these patients when they develop hydrocephalus. If they re-bleed, it's important that as soon as there's any change in their condition, we can be on top of it. And that's not going to happen unless they're in a 1-to-1, 1-to-2 nursing supervision ratio.
So we're talking chapter 2. We're talking hemorrhagic strokes. Two big categories, bleeding or not bleeding. So the hemorrhagic strokes are the bleeding strokes. And there's a lot of different things that can cause you to bleed into your brain. Things like a subarachnoid hemorrhage, a hypertensive hemorrhage, which classically occurs in the thalamus, the basal ganglia, the cerebellum, and the pons. You can have extension of ischemic stroke, have a big ischemic stroke, and then you start to bleed into the hole that's left over. You can obviously have traumatic bleeds. We're not talking about those right now. And then you can have things like cerebral venous thrombosis, which puts a lot of back pressure and then you start to bleed. Or, you know, hemorrhage from things like vasculitis, for example. Now, the good thing is you don't have to be a neuroanatomist or a pathologist to know what to do with all these patients who come in with a bleed in their brain, because initially it's all the same. It's elevate the head of the bed so that you get good drainage from that brain and you don't increase their intracranial pressure. Manage their airway if you need to. Control their blood pressure. We don't know exactly what that number is, but between 140 and 160 is what a lot of people say. Recent article said there was no difference between a systolic of 140 and a systolic of 180. Reverse their anticoagulants, so FFP or PCCs or vitamin K if they're on warfarin. If they're on one of the specific new agents, you might use a specific new reversal agent. Platelets as a routine don't work. You're going to call the neurointerventionalist or the neurosurgeon depending on what you find there. Sometimes they need surgery, for example, like a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Antiepileptics as a routine, no. But certainly if you've had a seizure, you should use them. And maybe if you've got a cortical sort of bleed, they'll use antiepileptics in those patients because they're pretty high risk. And of course, you're going to admit these patients to a very closely neuromonitored setting where they can get routine and frequent checks because this changes very quickly. And then depending on the specific type of the bleed as to what happens next. But it's good to know that that initial management, airway, breathing, circulation, head of the bed up, reverse their anticoagulation, treat any seizures that occur, don't give platelets, and call your neurosurgical specialist is good. It's easy. I can do that.